I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Our guest, the British travel writer Colin Foubran, recently set out on a solitary 15,000-mile journey across Siberia. He had traveled in Russia 17 years before, but Siberia, Russia's elsewhere, wasn't open to foreigners then. And in many ways, his trip across the 6,000 miles of bleak permafrost told him more about the essence of Russianness than any visit to Moscow or St. Petersburg in his past. The Siberia of the imagination is the rural wasteland into which Tsars and Stalin, too, discarded their political prisoners. But it is also the land of Russian innocence, strength, rustic character, populated by the descendants of Cossack fur traders, enterprising peasants, fleeing serfdom, and also of religious dissidents. Colin Foubran thinks of travel not as escape, but as a way to meet life head-on. On this trip, he may just have found Siberia's pulse through his hours on the endless steppe, in the ghosts of the gulags, and in the poor, hopeless, and hopeful people that he met. We're talking about the essence of Siberia and perhaps the essence of Russia this hour. Connection listeners, have you been there? Have you dreamed of riding that Trans-Siberian Railroad? Have you ever tried to imagine why writers, like Dostoevsky most especially, found a mystical reconciliation with the Russian peasantry, with the idea of Russianness in Siberia? 1-800-423-8255 is our Siberia phone. 1-800-423-TALK makes the Siberia connection with the writer Colin Foubran. Welcome back to The Connection. It's been thousands of miles and a few years since we've seen you. I've always wanted to take that train. That's the first admission. And I gather from your book it's a much more interesting ride now than it was when I first dreamed of it.
I think when you first dreamed of it, it was only possible really to get off at five different towns along the Trans-Siberian Railway, and that was virtually the end of it. Then, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, 1901-92, suddenly it became possible to go anywhere you liked there, unsupervised and alone. I know it doesn't sound the greatest invitation in the world, well, you can go where you like in Siberia now, but in fact, this is a twelfth of the land surface of the Earth. And to me, at least, it became a terrific temptation.
I want you to tell us what it looks like, and then eventually you're going to tell us how cold it is, too.
Well, it's varied. I mean, such a vast land is bound to be varied. I'd say that western Siberia is very flat, water and land almost interchangeable. The Siberians call it God's unfinished earth because the water is so loamy and the land is so marshy that they seem to be the same as one another. Then as you go east of the Yenisei into eastern Siberia, it becomes more hilly, embalmed in a terrible sort of static cold permafrost almost to the borders of China. But what you see is a fifth of the forest of the entire earth there, a vast belt of the taiga, as they call it, from the Urals right to the Pacific. To the south is steppe land through which the Trans-Siberian Railway goes. To the north is tundra, where the trees fade away and you get a subsoil of moss, lichens, bright coloured, like a sort of pattern, like a carpet. And so it is very varied. I think the most beautiful part are the mountains abutting Mongolia and China, which are very unspoiled. Altai and Sayan mountains, almost unknown, sitting there in the heart of Asia.
No shopping malls, no food courts in Siberia yet, right?
Rather few. They're just beginning to be touched by the West. A few Western companies have intruded in Yekaterinburg on the very far west of the of Siberia and the Urals. They even have a Coca-Cola plant.
Uh-oh. We better do this trip soon. First of all, just looking at the maps, the Trans-Siberian Railroad is very southern, almost... It's in the most nearly domesticated part of Siberia.
Yes.
And Omsk, which has always fascinated me because it's where Dostoevsky did his prison time in Siberia, is hard by Yekaterinburg. I mean, it's practically a suburban Moscow compared to the parts of Siberia you visited.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's relative. Being on the Trans-Siberian Railway, it's sort of within civilization, you feel. The Trans-Siberian was built, really, to link Siberia to the Western Russian motherland. But there are vast areas to the north, which are almost uninhabited, of course. And the only access, because it's a land of permafrost, is by river, unless you take a helicopter.
Who are the people that you meet in Siberia? And what are they doing, sort of, between passages of this train?
Well, they vary terribly. The distances are so huge that you get communities which have evolved, really, around specific, perhaps industrial sites or agricultural sites, or simply there because that is where they fled, maybe in the 19th or 18th centuries, and set up some sort of religious community. What you find is that almost all of them are ethnic Russians now. The people that the Russians originally conquered there when they went as Cossacks, at the end of the 16th century, they were Turkic and Mongoloid people, but very few. There's an analogy with Russia, with the American Wild West, of course. Mm. This is Russia's Wild East. But the resistance that the Russians had from these scattered tribes people was very little, and now they're just 4% of the total population. So they are there, you find, it particularly scattered in small agricultural groups. But in general, the people may have arrived from Western Russia into Siberia at any time. A vast number of them, of course, were moved there by Stalin, not necessarily because they were criminals, but simply in enforced work of some kind. Or they were lured there by high wages, hardship wages, basically, which might be three times as much as they'd earn in Western Russia.
You know, it has so many sort of reverse parallels or sort of mirror images of American history. I mean, there's something of our religious pilgrims there, something of our convict camps. I mean, it's a bit of Australia where they sent the convicts. It's a bit of our California gold rushers. It's a bit of our sort of Homestead Act free settlers. It's a bit of our Alaska gold rush, oil rush folk, all going in the opposite direction. Ours were headed west. The Russians were headed east. There's a passage early on in the book that sort of describes it and summarizes sort of how they got there. I wonder if you just read it.
I will. I've written, "This onset of migrants before the First World War was the climax of an eastward trickle which had been going on for three centuries and which had given Siberia its peculiar personality. In the wake of the 16th century Cossack bands trading in the soft gold of furs, came farmers and hunters, vagabonds and religious dissenters, whom European Russia either threatened or cramped. Sometimes encouraged, sometimes impeded, restless and ambitious peasants filtered into the timeless state lands to settle. Many were in flight from serfdom, others were in exile, but it was land hunger in the end which drove most from the oppressive, sometimes famine-stricken central provinces in the west, and the abolition of serfdom in 1861 turned the trickle to a steady flow. For long months they labored eastward beside horse-drawn carts heaped with household goods and sentimental treasures, and many died along the way. Only at the century's end did the railway ease their passage, and carried in such a tide of poorer peasantry that in less than 20 years Siberia's population had doubled to 10 million.
Can I just finish that? So the region became Russia's Wild East. It was born out of optimism and dissent. The power of the landowning nobility and of the church died over its huge distances, where the immigrant carved out all the estate he needed, sometimes subsidized by the crown, and held it as his own. Serfdom was illegal here. The only landowner who tried to enforce it, wrote a traveler, was instantly murdered. God is high up, and the Tsar is far off, the Siberians say. And their native aristocracy comprised not the corrupt bureaucrats sent out from St. Petersburg, whom they despised as ink souls, but their own rustic, self-made, and sometimes vastly wealthy merchant adventurers. They are a different breed. They're the heroic. I mean, they're our cowboys in a way, aren't they?
Yes. It's been very diluted now, but the sort of the basic original Siberian population was often in flight from some sort of oppression, and so they tended to attract the peasants, for instance, who were a little more enterprising than the others, and the ones who maybe had just that much more money that they could afford that journey, which often took a year and a half, and they would lose a child or two along the way. And then they would arrive in a land where they would simply settle and carve out as much land as they wanted. It was allowed. But these were people who were just a good deal more enterprising than those back at home, and that kind of defined them. Or they were dissident. They were sort of outcast. They were unwanted. People like the old believers, who were a little bit equivalent to, say, the Mormons or the Amish even. And those people found it safer to be far away, making their own destiny.
Can I just say or confess that part of what interests me in this whole subject of Siberia is one of my favorite books, Dostoevsky's Notes from the House of the Dead, which was his kind of barely fictionalized account of, I think, 4 years he did as prison time in Siberia. He wrote about the old believers. He wrote about people in pain, in loneliness, in cold, too. But it's especially interesting because then, in the middle of the 19th century, and also now, Russians have cultivated this romance that not only of sort of redemption through suffering, they'll get warm through being cold for so long, but also of finding themselves, finding their national identity in this kind of hardship and in these kinds of people. And sort of Dostoevsky found his, you know, a good piece of his neo-Orthodox Slavic nationalist identity in that period. And I keep wondering, reading your book, whether modern Russia wants to look in this kind of direction for its new footing after communism. Does this old myth, this old romance of the hard old Russians, apply today?
There's a nostalgia for it. There's a feeling that Western Russia, Moscow in particular, has fallen into the corrupting embrace of the West. This is an old Russian debate.
All that Coca-Cola, right?
Yeah, it's an old Russian debate. Are we Asian or are we European? Do we have an identity that's special to ourselves? Dostoevsky, of course, was one of the great proponents of Slavophilism, of the feeling that the Russians have something special to give the world, which is not Western. And Russians now, particularly those who resent the West, tend to look to Siberia as the place where the Russian soul is, the sort of essential Siberia, essential Russia, or at least Siberia is the place that Russia would like to be. Hmm. And if you look at the recent history, of course, this is the country where Russia has always regrouped against the West, whether it's the Napoleonic invasion or Hitler's invasion. Siberia is the land that's been unconquered, the one that represents their sort of purity. Even in the communist period, the usual Russian sort of superior censure of the Siberians as being ruffians and criminals and barbarians was often reversed into praise for the communist pioneers there as supermen, you know, building a new communist future. And indeed, the hardship of Siberia that afflicted workers there not only got them high wages, but could bring them high esteem, too.
Take those elements apart. First of all, I mean, does the nostalgia make any sense? But what is it that Russians look to Siberia for? Is it the landscape? Is it the hardship? Is it the cold? Is it a kind of pride in an ethnic, racial thing?
I think it's more sort of conceptual than factual. Most of the Russians that went to Siberia were in fact moved there in the last few generations, often under Stalin, or they were lured there by the higher wages. But the idea of Siberia to the Russians is of somewhere that is, in a way, sort of purifying of, say, capitalist corruption now, purifying of, in the 19th century, for instance, of European ideas of what civilization was, a land where the spirit reigned, and the Russians love to talk in these terms.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the spirit thing, because Dostoevsky, of course, celebrated the non-Western side of Russia, but he was also an Orthodox Christian who believed that in that Russian spirit was the true, it was there, not in Rome, that the kind of the true meaning of Christianity was kept.
Mm. And not only there, but among the peasant people. His experience in prison gave him eventually to feel, not at the time actually, because he was deeply disillusioned in many ways, certainly at the start of his prison sentence, but later he came to believe that something very special and particular resided in the Russian peasant. There was a sort of wisdom there. It was a very romantic concept, but he translated it back in the West into many of his novels, and you find it again and again, that redemption comes through suffering, through simplicity, and even through crime.
What traces do you see in Siberia at the turn of this century?
Traces of...
Of that spiritual consciousness, of that stubborn spiritual life. Would Dostoevsky find it in the year 2000 in Siberia?
I think he would be most likely to recognize it in those villages which I find of old believers, a people who had really been expelled out there at a time 200 years ago when they were going for dissident beliefs which seem almost unimaginably unimportant now. To them it was so much about how many fingers you used to cross yourself with, or how many alleluias there were in the liturgy and such things. But they lived and died for these things because they felt themselves to be on the brink of apocalypse, on the brink of the last day. And now those communities out in Russia, which Dostoevsky would certainly recognize, are the only ones, I think, perhaps in the whole of Russia, who are living with extreme providence and industry and are quietly still flourishing, but they are waiting for the last trump to sound at any moment and keeping themselves ready for it. And materially, they were, I think, much the best-off agricultural community that I've found in Russia at all.
I think they're waiting for a connection delegation to go and visit them soon, I hope. This is wonderful. Colin Thubrin is our guest, a British traveler and writer. His new book is called In Siberia, Across 15,000 Miles of It, the part of a country that's bigger than any other country in the world, the world's byword for frozen exile, Siberia. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Siberia connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. Would you sign up for a trip? Michael is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Are you ready, Michael?
Good morning, gentlemen. Interesting topic. My question has to do with the quality of the environment in Siberia. I remember the Boston Globe Sunday magazine a few years ago did a cover story about it, which was essentially a litany of horror stories of environmental degradation, sort of Siberia as the dumping ground of the Soviet industrial complex. And I was wondering if the writer, if your guest saw this and could comment on the extent of it, because the magazine piece was a really dim view of, you know, whole tracks polluted with radiation and chemical issues and groundwater and high incidence of birth defects and so forth. And I was curious as to what your guest found.
Michael, thank you. I think you're on a case here.
Yes, interesting and highly relevant. In the way of my journey, of course, it was fragmentary and completely uncomprehensive. But what I found, I think, principally, was lumbering, which is being done particularly by Korean companies in the Far East, which is having some effect even on this vast stretch of forest. The state lumbering camps in Russia are now rather run down, and one finds this again and again, that the decline of Russian industry has paradoxically helped the environment. There's less being dumped in the rivers in some cases, but all those great rivers, the Ob, the Yenisei, and the Lena, have all to some extent been polluted. And of course it's a very fragile environment because it's so cold. The resistance to pollution of water, cold water, is less. It's difficult for me to assess, really, in the cities quite the degree to which pollution is affecting the countryside. But for instance, I was in an Arctic town, little village really, called Patalovo, a town of reindeer herders, and the reindeer pasture had been severely degraded by the nickel processing factories of Norilsk, which were 100 miles to the north. And this is what's happening in this very frail ecology, that when there is industry, usually uncontrolled, at least by Western standards, it's affecting the land out of proportion to what you'd expect. The country is so vast that I think the horror stories are perhaps, one hates to be smug about such things, you can't possibly be, but a little bit exaggerated. You do go through hundreds and hundreds of miles of untouched forest, untouched hills in Siberia. So it is still a relatively uncontaminated country.
Was it a dump of nuclear materials, for example?
It has been, and the rivers have to some extent been affected by that. I think it was a dump above all in the Stalin period for heavy industry. He decided that because the population in Siberia was so thin, that the labor-intensive industries should be concentrated in European Russia, the heavy industries needing electrical power should be in Siberia. So it's always been a land, for the last half century or more, 80 years, of heavy industry, and that's been polluting.
Michael, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the Siberia connection. Andre is on the line.
Hi, Chris. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Andre.
Okay. I've been a frequent caller whenever you host a program in Kosovo, if you remember. But apart from that, I also happen to be a Siberian. And first of all, I would like to thank you for your topic today, and I would like to share a personal experience. When you said that the Siberians are tough and real survivors, this is so true, you know. I was born on the Trans-Siberian Railroad, in fact, in 1960. My mother, a Siberian girl herself, was on her way to give me birth from Moscow to Semipalatinsk, when the rest of the family lived at the time. And I guess the railroad was bumpy, and anyway, she ended up, it was a premature birth, 7 months, she ended up in an emergency room of a tank factory in a town called Ruptsovsk, over the border.
Welcome to the world, Andrei.
Right. Well, just over the border of the northeastern Kazakhstan at the Irtysh River. Now, it was a classified city at the time, and it wasn't even on the map. It is now. So the place of my birth was actually entered as Semipalatinsk, the next town, for this high security reasons, I guess. And I spent the first 4 years of my life in the middle of Siberia, in Semipalatinsk, the town where Dostoevsky was exiled, if you remember. And one of my most thrilling experiences was having been baptized in the church that Dostoevsky frequented.
My word!
Of his exile, yes. And it's just all over great, you know. In a curious way, I became a U.S. citizen just yesterday. But when you announced your topic this morning, it just made me reflect on my roots, and I just had to call in.
Andre, these are important connections from Dostoevsky's church to American citizenship. I just wonder, what does it mean in ordinary Russia to identify yourself as a Siberian? I mean, what would you compare it to in this country?
Right.
How is it different from being a Georgian?
Right. The rough equivalent would be the frontier people, the Midwesterners. Very pristine, very, very, very tough, very survivor types as opposed to the eastern seaboard, northeast. And you know, maybe you can make a closer connection on that. But very, very, very independent, known as very independent, very tough.
Something you brag about. You throw out your chest when you say, I'm a Siberian.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Interesting. Like, I'm a Sicilian.
Yes.
Andre, thank you.
No problem, sir.
Fascinating. Yes, that sort of tale is stranger in the States than it would be in Russia. One hears again and again of extraordinary stories of survival. I haven't heard of anybody being born in a tank compound before.
Just off the train, right. Andre, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Jean is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Jean.
Hi. I have a simple anecdote. My husband, who is an astrophysicist, and my son, who is a writer and adventurer, went to Siberia 2 years ago. They went to the eclipse and to see Lake Baikal and ski around Lake Baikal. So their hosts were villagers, guides, and they ate from their greenhouses. They were not religious people, but they would call them spiritual because of a certain quality of empathy and caring. Mm-hmm. Very caring people. My funny anecdote is that when they were heading out to Lake Baikal, which was threatening because some of the ice had capitulated under some very large trucks, and they were going to cross it. So Stanley, their guide, rolled up his sleeves and said, "We have a saying in Russia and in Siberia, which is the sooner you go to prison, the sooner you get out." So they negotiated it successfully. They went across the Trans-Siberian Railway from Beijing back through Mongolia to Hong Kong, and found themselves totally warmed in this cold environment by the wonderful people.
Hmm. Jean, you make me want to go traveling. We should all do it. Thank you. We're going traveling with the writer Colin Thubrin, British writer whose new book is called In Siberia, about his own 15,000-mile trek across what would be the biggest country in the world. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners at WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about Siberia with the British travel writer Colin Thubrin. Till the very end of the Soviet period in Russia, Siberia was, among many other things, a prison camp, and it was essentially off-limits to travelers, even those hardy travelers on the Trans-Siberian Railroad who could only get off and walk around under supervision at four or five stops. But it all changed rather dramatically with the new Russia in 1990 and 91. Colin Thubrin, what did happen at the end of the Soviet period, and how is Siberia going to be different in the new century?
Well, what happened from the traveler's point of view, of course, was that Soviet law vanished, and it was possible to travel wherever you liked, alone, unsupervised, in this colossal area. What happened economically had almost started to happen even before the collapse of the Soviet Union, that the special concessions that were given to Siberians of cheap consumer goods and food and so on were no longer being given by Moscow. They simply vanished in 1989, and this sort of initiative fell to commercial enterprises that didn't fulfill it. And, of course, the collective farms broke up, which made for chaos. Some peasants wanted to keep their bit of a collective farm, their few acres, and to farm them. Others tried to go into the cities. The whole machinery began to collapse. For instance, I was in western Siberia, and I came to the village where Vesputin was born. And a putative great-grandson of Vesputin was still living there. He looked eerily like Vesputin. Yes. And he told me...
Give us the short form on Rasputin, who was the great advisor to... indestructible advisor to the last of the Tsars.
Yeah. Yes, he was their sort of evil holy man, as you might say. He appeared to have the power to cure their son, who was diseased. And who knows what he really did, but he also had a reputation of being a sort of incarnation of evil and was murdered in 1915 or 1916. And anyway, in this village, his so-called great-grandson was left, who he was really, I don't know, he just said that his great-grandmother had been Rasputin's maid, and he thought that she had sinned with him, as he put it. And his bit of land, he had just simply given up and sold to somebody in exchange for vodka, rented it out, and was now selling potatoes.
Still selling it as Rasputin's vodka,
yeah,
right?
But that sort of thing has happened everywhere, that in those agricultural communities, the whole sort of infrastructure has gone, the agricultural machinery, the spare parts on there, and so on. And almost everywhere you went, things have declined and collapsed, along with the industrial situation of Western Russia. It was a terribly centralized system, and there's still...
Can it survive in freedom, do you suppose?
They're trying to detach themselves. The different provinces are trying to detach themselves from the center, try to get more economic freedom, not political freedom, but economic freedom. And that, I suppose, is slowly happening.
Can you still find traces of prison camps in Siberia today? Did you see any?
Yes. You come across them in out-of-the-way areas. I remember even north of Lake Baikal, which one of our listeners was talking about, which is a relatively civilized and familiar part of Siberia. I was wandering in some woods and came upon the remains of a mica mine, which had been mined up to 1939 in the Stalin period, which was lying around, you know, a few watchtowers fallen in the forest. In the far northeast of Siberia, in the Kolyma area, which was the worst of all Stalin's gulags, I came across several of these places. A young geologist took me to a uranium mining complex, which had been a terrible gulag. Even the guards didn't know that this radioactive earth was fatal. And now, it had been abandoned, I think, in the late 50s. And now, when I went there, it was heavily under snow. You just found a few offices of the guards' personnel. The roofs had fallen in, but their stoves, their sauna was still there. There was a pair of boots discarded by the stove. The prisoners' cemetery was a few graves of numbered, unmarked. They had no names, just numbers under the snow. And your feet kept hitting bits of iron under the snow, and you didn't know what you were making contact with. And the watchtowers fallen. And the beds of the guards were still there, heaped with crystalline snow. It very eerie.
1-800-423-8255 makes the In Siberia connection with the writer Colin Thubrin. 1-800-423-TALK. Dick is on the line.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Welcome, Dick.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I wanted to ask Mr. Thubrin, is it P-H-I-O?
No, Thubrin. T for Tom, H-U-B. R-O-N.
T-U-H-B-R-O-N.
Thubrin.
Thubrin. Thank you. Did you come across any remnants of the so-called Jewish Autonomous Republic? In the 1920s, the Soviets wanted to set up, a homeland for the Jews. And I've read something about it, several stories in history. Did you come across anything of those remnants?
An interesting question. Yes, I did. The area you're talking about is Birobidzhan, isn't it?
Birobidzhan, yes.
Yes, which was set up in 1928 as an alternative to Palestine, an astonishing initiative, and I don't know what really lay behind it. I think in part it was to attract Zionist money or Jewish money to the Soviet Union, but mainly to deal with what they thought was a Jewish problem, as they called it, which was Jews who they wanted to settle on the land and turned into good Soviet citizens. And so they gave them this awful, undrained marshland, really, not far from the Mongolian or the Chinese border in Birobidzhan, the Chinese border.
Right.
I went there. The community is almost gone now. They were terribly persecuted in twice, once before the Second World War and once soon after. And the leaders were liquidated. In more recent years, the Jews that were there have emigrated out, either to Israel or to Germany, or eventually to the States. And it was very sad. I found the little synagogue that was still left to them. And
there's
still a very small synagogue, little wooden synagogue with a garden.
Okay.
And but the number of Jews there are so few that they can't even find a quorum for prayer. But there are two or three still there in the synagogue supervising it. But they too were planning to leave, and they said that within a few years there would be nobody left there except the very sick.
Yeah.
Dick, I wonder, how did you know about it?
Oh, from several sources. It's been in the I've been reading about it over the years, and also there's a recent book by Ken Korfoof, who wrote a bunch of short stories, and one of them is about, it's a fictional account about a couple who went out there and what happened to them.
Is this the book by Ken Kalfas?
It's a book called PU-239. It's a bunch of short stories. It was recently published in 1999 by Milkweed Press. You got to read it.
Get
the author on the connection, by the way.
We'll work at it. Dick, thank you.
Very important.
Thank you.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255, the In Siberia connection with Colin Thubrin. Edward is calling from Amherst, New York.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Edward.
Good morning.
I'm interested primarily in whether or not Colin might give me the answer to the following question. Is the Russian language spoken in that part of Russia very similar to, is it different from the language spoken in Moscow? That's one part of the question. And the other is, have you encountered languages other than Russian spoken in that part of Russia, primarily as a result of many of the exiles who were sent there from Eastern Europe, like the Ukraine, Poland? What is the status of the languages that you encountered on the Trans-Siberian?
Well, on the Trans-Siberian, one wouldn't get, I think, great variety, but in overall Siberia, you do. My Russian is not sensitive enough to be able to pick up on all the different kinds, but in general, because the vast number, the majority of Siberians, I would say, have been pushed out in the sort of Stalin period, or at least sort of third or second or third generation from Western Russia, there's not such a vast difference in language or linguistic pronunciation as you would think. There are old Siberian families that do pride themselves on speaking rather differently from other Russians. In general, as regards other languages, I met Poles who had remembered their Polish. There were Volga Germans who had been exiled out there, but often they couldn't remember German at all. The native peoples still cling to their own languages, although they were obligatorily sent, their children in the 60s in particular, to the internat schools, which made them speak Russian, and it was even forbidden for them to speak their own native languages, even with their families, supposedly. So you get the survival of languages like Yakut or Buryat, of these small sort of minority peoples that still do remember their languages, but they are often bilingual too because they've been forced to learn Russian in school. This is a situation that's starting to reverse itself now, and that those languages, those small languages, are reviving.
Edward, thank you. Can I just segue from language to sort of political belief? Were they ever communists in Siberia, do you suppose? And what's filled the void of communism in ideological, political terms in the last 10 years?
They were communists, all right. I mean, everybody officially was. They they were, like most Russians, by the 1980s, they were cynical about communism. they tended to sort of simply regard it as a kind of necessity of life. It intruded into all areas of life. And with its demise, although they were so cynical about it, I think you realize now that it did supply a framework and a rhetoric for people who are naturally very religious, who want to put their trust in something. And with its disappearance, there's a great sort of gulf in Russian life, a spiritual gulf, into which are coming religion up to a point, the Orthodox religion, some Protestant religions in the cities, often sponsored by the states, a mild resurgence of very damaged pagan cultures like the Yakut, the Buryat, and the smaller cultures in the north, which were shamanistic in origin. And these religions are returning, but it's a limited return. Even the Orthodox religion is less a great evangelical revival than a kind of reinstatement of Russia's personality, the old personality of the motherland.
We're letting Colin Thubrin lead us through Siberia this hour. 1-800-423-8255. Makes the Siberia connection. Zeke is on the line.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Zeke.
I noticed Mr. Sobran's book at Harvard Coop, and I even lived through, so thank you so much for writing about that.
Thank you.
And I want to make a couple of comments about Jewish Autonomous Region, which is the official name. It's very easy to discover it. You just open the maps of the Soviet Union or Russia. And also, this Jewish Autonomous Region is much larger than Israel, which is kind of interesting. And I think it should be stressed that Stalin sent Jews there because Jews were very active supporters of revolution, and he wanted to use them, it's part of the reason, on their strategic border with China, just to guard the strategic region.
Yes, I'm sure that's right. They were very scared of China at the time and wanted to populate that area, not necessarily with Jews, but with anybody that they could get to go there. I'm sure that's right. And they felt, I think, after the Russian Civil War and the pogroms and so on, the persecution of many Jewish communities in that time, there were Jews, I think, that the Russians felt they couldn't quite control, and they wanted to settle them down, take them away from what they thought of as casual commerce, and get them to be good Soviet farmers in the Soviet mold.
Yeah.
Does that sound right to you, Zeke?
Siberia is very close to my heart because I spent my childhood there. And I also want to say that it's so vast, and their population, as it sounded on the program, was so thin that there were people there who even didn't know about the revolution in Russia or about Second World War. So you could hide in taiga and nobody could find you.
I think it was just about possible. You soon got to know about the revolution.
About people who were going deep in Siberia, and they were not reachable.
I think there are very few communities like that. It is true. I think there were some, but it's astonishing that you can go into the most remote parts of Siberia, hoping that the reach of Stalin would not have found them. And you find that they've been collectivized and they've been persecuted.
Zeke, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Eva is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Eva.
Yes, I'm. My name's Eva Friedman, and I'm from Sudbury, Mass. And I'm a scholar who has worked in Siberia, particularly southern Siberia, on questions around the regeneration of religion, specifically shamanism. And I've done quite a lot of research in the Lake Baikal area, among the Buryats, among the Tuvinians, and also among the Kalmucks, actually, in western Russia. Mm-hmm. And my question was whether Colin Fabron has come across shamans in his travels.
Sure did. He did, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, interestingly that you talk about Tuva, because I did there hunt for shamans. And as you must know, I think, if you've been there recently, in Kizil, there's even what they call an association of shamans, which is sort of ridiculous for these people who are quintessential loners.
Yes, I know all about it.
I found...
And they overcharge, by the way.
It was absurd. I did find one shaman who claimed to be in some sort of ancestral line from Mongolian shamans. He called himself a yellow shaman. And he despised that school, and he lived usually in a village, although he had a little hut in Kizil too. And he had his shaman's regalia, which he showed me, and so on. An old man, I have thought that, you know, with all the sort of Soviet propaganda, it obviously affected me a bit, because I was expecting to meet, some sort of strange magician. And here was this rather sweet old herbal doctor, really, who I thought was just a medicine man, and then after I'd got his trust, he showed me his regalia, his feathered headdress and his tambour and so on. But that was the only person I met who I think was some sort of genuine shaman, and he himself said that the line was hopelessly broken, and all those that were pretending...
What do you pay a shaman to do for you?
Usually healing of some sort. Traditionally, they were, as I'm sure... Eva knows, of course you would, that they were sort of usually used for rather deep spiritual healing for troubles in the tribal group rather than for the more superficial sorts of healing.
What does the healing cost?
Oh, I think it must vary. Not sure now. It simply doesn't. It's not a question now.
Eva, thank you for bringing up shamanism. 1-800-423-8255. Bart is calling from Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts.
Hello, hi.
Welcome, Bart.
Great show. I really love it. It's
the
best show in the universe. I've got some information here from a book I recently read, which blew my socks off, called Lies My Teacher Told Me. And James Lowen talks about the American Expeditionary Force that was sent by Wilson into eastern Siberia to Lake Baikal between 1918 and 1920. And he quotes from a Robert Maddox book called The Unknown War with Russia, quote, "The immediate effect of the intervention was to prolong a bloody civil war, thereby costing thousands of additional lives and wreaking enormous destruction on an already battered society. And there were longer-range implications. Bolshevik leaders had clear proof that the Western powers meant to destroy the Soviet government if given the chance." So I was really shocked but not surprised that we might have, way back then, for whatever reasons we thought were good, contributed to a polarization and a prolonged hardline Cold War.
I think that's what's happened. Of course, it's easy in retrospect to see. But yes, not only America, but England, the Allies were responsible for prolonging something that now appears sort of to be inevitable. But there was a time during that Civil War when the whites, with their Western supporters, must have felt they were almost on the brink of success. So it's of course easy from our vantage point to cast blame, but certainly the effect of the American intervention and the Japanese and European was entirely detrimental.
Hmm. Bart, interesting. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Mary Jane is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Mary Jane.
This isn't about Siberia per se, but I just ask anyone who's been to Russia, what is Solzhenitsyn doing, and what is his current reputation?
It seems to me, talking to Russian friends, say, in Moscow, that he is completely sidelined, that they regard him as a sort of eccentric voice crying in the wilderness, and that the energy and that the effect he had is all in the past. It's been considerable, of course. He was a giant. But now, I'm afraid, he seems increasingly to the Russians to be quite irrelevant.
Mary Jane, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. There was somebody else there. Monica is on the line. Hello, Monica. Are you there, Monica?
She's gone to the gulag.
Absolutely.
I thought you'd gone to Siberia, Monica.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello to the distinguished guests and to Chris. I love your programs, and I'm fascinated by today's topic. I can never hear enough about Russia. But I wanted to know if you've seen the movie Siberiade. It's a two-part film, a Russian film, and it's absolutely mind-boggling what the Siberians have had to go through. And I hope that you will have a chance to see it.
Where would we see it, Monica?
Well, the University of New Hampshire played it for the students here, and I was lucky to see it. It's maybe in the video stores. I don't know. It's
Siberiade. This is
Siberiade, part one, part two.
Thank you very much.
Is this a documentary?
It's not a documentary. It's an actual film, but it's great for discussion afterwards. The life they led and the development over two generations. It's a wonderful film. I can only recommend it.
Thank you very much. I'm ashamed to say I've never heard of it. Thank you.
If you can't get to the movie, you can read Colin Thubrin's book, In Siberia, a wonderful account and a wonderful trip we've taken this past hour. I have to just say about Solzhenitsyn, I mean, it's horrible to think that man is deemed irrelevant. He won't be for long, he certainly won't be forever, and he certainly won't be forgotten in the history of the meaning of Siberia either.
Certainly not, no.
Colin Thubrin,
thank you.
Thank you enormously. The book is called In Siberia, 15,000 miles across the wasteland, or is it, of Russia? I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Cassettes of The Connection are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.